He got that giant slingshot operation going around December of that of 68.
Right away.
Mm-hmm. And then the others followed shortly thereafter.
He's pretty quick, huh?
Yes, sir. That he's got that reputation. Now, one of the things that started happening after we did the initial big thrust towards our turning our program, our assets over to Vietnamese, we called that ACTOV, A-C-T-O-V, which was accelerated turnover of our forces to the Vietnamese.
Okay.
Used ACTOV because it sounded like active, you know. But and we used that in all the messages that went back and forth, so everybody knew what we were talking about. But when we first briefed the first situation report on that to General Abrams, which was something like 30 or 45 days after that initial briefing, we gave him a briefing on how we were doing. We showed him a picture of that hotel that we'd taken over for the boat school and explained to him how we were operating the boat school and how it was going and so forth. For some time, it turns out, he had been trying to get the Army to expand their English language teaching capability for the Vietnamese Army. And the excuse was they didn't have any facilities to do it. They did have their English language program in an old broken down area out near the Vietnamese Joint General Staff. There were a lot of old barracks out there and classrooms that had gotten pretty well beat up in the Tet of 68. Anyway, as soon as General Abrams saw our hotel, he immediately got his staff and said, Navy can do it, why can't you? So pretty soon they got a couple of hotels and they got some English language training going on a large scale, somewhat more formally than we were. They were using the Defense Language Institute and on a regular formal thing, but the idea was still the same. And as a matter of fact, we also got another hotel and taught pure English to people that were going to go into officer programs and that were going to come back to our country to go to schools back here and this sort of thing. Very similar to what the Army did, also under the aegis of the Defense Language Institute. But this was one of several things that Admiral Zumwalt had started, and it gave General Abrams an idea. Now, in February of 69 now, Mr. Nixon took over in January, and Mr. Laird became his department, his Secretary of Defense. In February, Mr. Laird came over and made a tour of Vietnam, and the MACV staff over there, in their wisdom, had laid out his whole schedule and his whole briefing schedule and so forth. And nowhere, anywhere on there was an indication for the Navy to make any presentation to Mr. Laird. So Admiral Zumwalt called up his friend, I think he was a Major General, Major General Julian Ewell.
Yeah, he told me this story, about how he got in there.
And said, you mind if I come down and use 5-10 minutes of your time? Because Julian had 30 minutes. It was at the 9th Infantry Division headquarters down at Dong Tan, and I told you that the 9th Infantry Division was the outfit that we transported in our armored craft. That's one of the reasons that they were very close. Also, Julian was like Admiral Zumwalt in many ways. He's one of the best generals, Army generals over there. He he was patterned after the Abrams model, and he was a real fighter. And the association was quite close, and they became quite close friends. And so we went down there with a presentation that we put together for Mr. Laird. As it turned out, during the half-hour period, and we went first, I think that we used 20 minutes or maybe even 25 minutes. I know that General Yule had to cut his way down, and he kind of ad-libbed it. He's very good. Everybody knew him by reputation anyway. So, but the reason I mentioned the other thing about General Abrams seeing our school and seeing some of the other things that Admiral Zumwalt had done is that I know for a fact that General Abrams mentioned this man Zumwalt and his aggressiveness and how fast he was working and that sort of thing to most visitors that came over. I know Admiral McCain told us of things that he learned from General Abrams on how well the Navy was doing, this sort of thing. General Abrams and Admiral Zumwalt became quite close, and they had the very highest respect for each other. So I think that a lot of the reputation that Admiral Zumwalt was getting back in Washington was coming through General Abrams, some through Admiral McCain, I presume, too. But at any rate, he gave that presentation down there. What he covered was, as I recall, something like maybe 60% on the operation that he was involved in, and maybe 40% on how he was pursuing this turnover program and what he was doing. In the operational side, it was very much like I've already described to you. He talked about pretty much the 1965 situation, the infiltration, how the market time along the coast kind of stopped that, forced them to use the main branch of the Mekong, how the game warden operation had stopped that. Then he talked about the riverine forces. And then he showed what the situation was now and where the major infiltration was coming in. Incidentally, it was not in those days, it was not only just the Ho Chi Minh Trail. In those days, Sihanoukville in Cambodia, yeah, was a place where there was sea supply, and then they would take it from Sihanoukville and bring it down through those overland spots that I mentioned. And he pointed out how he now had this interdiction line to about this 250 miles and so forth, because it pretty well just about completed the whole thing by the time Mr. Laird got over. And then he talked to him very briefly about our operation. We had pictures of everything. We showed pictures of the boat school and showed pictures of the construction up there at Cameron Bay of the new facilities. And actually showed pictures of guys in classrooms studying that weren't there, you know, two months before and so forth. As a result, Mr. Chaffee told me later, and I don't know, I assume that it was true, but I had never gotten from any other source, when I was debriefing the Secretary of the Navy, when I came back on some occasion, I forget which one it was, he was talking to me, and he said, "Did you know that it was after Mr. Laird saw that presentation of Admiral Zumwalt's down there at Dong Tam that He formulated the term Vietnamization. And, I don't know if it's true or not, but it's what the Secretary of Navy told me. So I think it did, in fact, have a big impact on Mr. Laird and spurred him on. That was a thing that probably was that was passed along from president to president, but I think that this may have been the thing that told Mr. Laird that, you know, if we really ought to make a big effort in this direction. I'm surmising.
I gather that among Zumwalt's specific talents, he's a real good briefer.
He's an excellent, outstanding briefer.
Yeah.
Right.
That doesn't hurt, I suppose, the way things go. I mean, just this, the way the drill goes of getting programs across, I guess that's a big help to you.
It is, as a commander of the naval forces of Vietnam, and it is as the chief of naval operations, because you've got to prepare a good story and a good justification to convince somebody the importance of your program. Now, you know, he, when he became CNO, put together a briefing on force levels and the need for force levels and need for a Navy budget and so forth. Within the first couple of months.
Project 60, that one?
That's right. After Project 60, then he put together some briefing material. And he used to have breakfast that a senator or a congressman would host for another 10 or 15 congressmen or senators. And he would give this presentation. And he did this over and over and over again. And he'll be able to tell you what percentage he got to, but I think after a period of time he felt that he had gotten to virtually all of the Senate, you know, on a small group basis, and something well over 50% of the House.
Isn't that what every chief tries to do, though, or is this
to my knowledge, nobody's ever done that small group briefing.
Really?
If you know,
I don't know. I mean, I just don't know. I would have assumed
I think that's unique.
That every service chief regards it as one of his primary duties to put the message across to Congress, and I wonder.
Well, that's right. But they deal primarily, sir, with the heads of the four committees, the two Armed Forces committees and the two
appropriations.
But. Admiral, well, plus other well-known people, but Admiral Zumwalt tried to really, in a small, personalized group, give his presentation to virtually the whole Congress.
Interesting. Well, that's
but here again, I pick up on that when you mention his briefing capability.
Yeah. No, well, that's something I'm glad to. That was something I didn't realize. A good new thing. Do you know anything about the other part of the business of his getting appointed? The what he said to Chafee in the interview when he was called back. That's part of it you don't know.
I knew always when he was coming back, and it was kept very close hold. Well, they always do that.
Yeah.
When they bring four or five people into the city to interview them for that job, it's done as surreptitiously as possible.
Yeah, there's enough trouble with that.
And he came back for some other trumped-up reason. And sometime around in April, more earlier than maybe March or April, but he'll know the facts on that. And I don't know why I knew what he's coming for, but I did. Or at least I was pretty sure I did.
Yeah, I told you.
he told me when he got back. And then, which just thrilled me, because there were a lot of things that we had seen in Vietnam that weren't a bad idea to try out on the U.S. Navy. And,
did he make any marked moves in the direction in the personnel field while he was commanding in Vietnam?
Well, there's one area that I might dwell on. The big thing was his constant concern for each person. I think he felt like a father every time somebody got killed. I really did. That was really hard on him. And of course, to add to the difficulty, he was a father of a person over there for most of the time.
Was his Marine son over there?
No, but his oldest son was in the Navy a short period of time after he graduated from North Carolina.
Oh.
He came in... he went through the ROTC program in North Carolina and became an ensign, and he came over there and had one of those little 50-foot swift boats that I mentioned on the inshore patrol. But he didn't do any of that patrolling. He was always in the thick of it, and he was always making those incursions into the rivers and going places where it was tough and that sort of thing, which I know it was a big concern to the admiral, but he also was concerned about every person out there. He really was.
Did the Navy have as high a percentage of casualties as the other services?
No, I don't. I can get those figures, but...
wasn't quite as perilous, though.
It was not, no, but it was high when we started a couple of those operations, that giant slingshot. We got all kinds of intelligence to indicate that really hurt the enemy. Yeah. And so they were putting up a pretty good fight.
You did pay a price for that, then.
Yeah, it got up, but I forget the figures.
I suppose offshore patrol was fairly safe.
Yeah, unless you made those incursions. Yeah. But generally, just the patrolling was relatively safe.
However, in a combat zone, you don't have to issue too many orders about uniforms and haircuts and stuff like that, I wouldn't gather.
It was an issue that never came up.
Yeah, right.
But what I'm mentioning is just his really concern and really love, is the best way to describe it, I know, for the dedication and sacrifice that all those young guys were making. Just the antithesis of what the image was of the young person in this country.
What was the duty? What was the duty like there? How many days on and how much off, and where do you go when you're off and all that kind of stuff? So it's like the guys in the river patrols.
For the young people?
Yeah.
Oh, they all handled it differently. The war, of course, was a 7-day-a-week sort of thing. It was mostly at night. There were day patrols, and about one out of every 5 or 6 or 7, I guess, firefights that would occur during the day. But it was mostly a nighttime thing. So that
for a month and then off for a few days, or what? I mean, what were the working conditions?
No, it was more out on patrol one night, and then maybe somebody else would go the second night, and then they would be back out the third or something like that. It was, and they'd sleep during the day, and that kind of.
Well, I get back to R&R how often?
Just once while you were there for 1 week. It was a 1-year tour, and during 1 week you'd get R&R somewhere, which most everybody would. There was, generally, you'd spend your entire time
right there.
In whatever little base that you went to. Now, the bases could be anywhere from an LST anchored in a river somewhere to a larger barrack ship that was anchored in a river to a
town,
a little town, and or you know a base beside a town where there would be small barracks and small office buildings and repair shops and this sort of thing.
But the town would have bars and women and
all that stuff. Right. Now, you know, occasionally a guy could get off a couple of days and come up to Saigon or go to any other towns and so sort of thing, but most of them stayed in the field most of the time.
Was like that, though.
Now, we supplied our people well, you know. We had air conditioning and a lot of the little little barracks places. Some did not, a lot did not, but most every one of the little bases had a club of some sort where you could buy beer and you could go listen to music and that kind of thing.
Hot meals and dry beds and maybe is always supposed to provide everything.
Well, it was a little bit more like the Army living than it was the Navy, because a lot of those outposts were really just a little fenced-in area right on the bank of the river somewhere. And we might, in some cases, only just carry up some of these pontoons. They build something on a pontoon or just tie a pontoon to a bank somewhere and put up a couple little crude barracks sort of thing. So not only did our guys have to be concerned about their operation on the river, but they also, for the first time in their lives, had to worry about land security. And so we had people standing watches and outposts guarding the fence, because you didn't want to take the chance of getting your little base overrun. And sometimes you get a big mortar attack, and of course the best defense was getting into the boats and using the firepower on the boats, because you had a lot of firepower on that. But it was quite an operation, and in answer to your question about his efforts in the personnel area, he just felt very close to those guys and tried real hard to make it as pleasant for them as he could. You know, in that giant slingshot operation, I think the very first time that he visited each one of these little outposts that we just set up on the bank of those two rivers, they had refrigerators and many cases of beer and Coca-Cola and that sort of thing. So, you know, that stuff always went up early as soon as we had set something up.
How did they get supplied, by helicopter?
And boat. Both helicopter and boat. Right. Now,
well, that gives me a notion about the Vietnam.
Now, there's one other thing you want to talk about up there, because it's got a bearing, and that is there was a concern for what would happen when we put the Vietnamese and U.S. Young people in the same boat and the same crew, since their cultures were so much different. And we got a briefing early on out there by a man that had some experience in working with this intercultural problem in Turkey
Turkey's a tough one. I've been there. I know what it's like out there.
Yeah, and in Korea, and he was at the moment working under a contract with the Army in Taiwan. And we found out about it and asked him to come over and talk to us. From listening to him, Admiral Sonnenwalt had us put together what we called a personal response program. And we had just all these things just kind of fell out. We had a Navy chaplain who was over there who had just completed a year's graduate work in Princeton, I guess, in the behavioral science area. And so between this chaplain and this man that we talked to in Thailand that was working for the Army, we devised some sort of system whereby we could talk to our people about the problems of dealing with somebody from a completely different culture. The mechanism that we used was we would go into an area and we'd do a 10% sample survey of Navy people and of any indigenous people that had any association with the Navy. And we'd try to find out from each side.
Attitudes, sir.
Right. What's, are you anti-Vietnamese or are you anti-American? That's right. Yeah. Exactly. Or are you pro-American, pro-Vietnamese? And how about the majority of people who you associate with? Are they anti-Vietnamese or are they pro-Vietnamese? When you get these statistics, you'd find out that there was usually a vocal minority, that there was usually fewer people against the Vietnamese than everybody thought.
Than it looked like there
than
was.
Everybody thought was against the Vietnamese.
Well, how much do people lie? I mean, everybody knows what the purpose of such questionnaires are, and some of them lie like hell when they answer those questions, I'm sure.
Sure, I couldn't agree more. But it gives you something to go back in and sit down with a group of people, and it gives you a departing place to get into a discussion.
Of course, the people who lie are people that you can move. Well, they're people you can move,
yeah,
anyway.
Well, it doesn't matter anyway. And so, we'd also...
There are people who are ashamed of themselves, the people who lie, so you can influence group. That's
right.
What I mean.
Yes, sir. We'd also ask questions, what are the five things you like least about the Vietnamese rank order? What are the five things you like best about? We'd ask the Vietnamese about us. What you'd always get when you ask the Vietnamese or the Turks or anybody else in the whole damn world what they don't like about us is our superior air. We very, very cleverly alienated the whole goddamn world by now.
That news for the Turks, what I don't like about them is their superior air.
Well, maybe we've got some like that. The French are kind of that way, too.
Yeah, right.
But everybody, no matter who you talk to, thinks that about the Americans.
Yeah.
And so you can talk to you guys about that. Now, what is it you don't like about the Vietnamese? Well, the biggest thing is they're always trying to take you. Oh, what do you mean by that? How many Vietnamese do you know? I know some girl at such and such a bar, and I know the last time I was there I got rolled and all this sort of thing. And how about Norfolk? Were you ever rolled in Norfolk? Well, yeah, but that's different. Oh, it is. Were you ever, and then another thing is that they don't like the filth, and the sanitary conditions. Well, then you start talking about if your country had been engaged in the war for 25 years, where would your priorities lie, would you...
How much garbage collection was going to get done. Huh?
That's right, and... Essentially, what you try to do was kind of lay things out and get people to be objective about them, to tie them to a reality that they were familiar with, and try to understand why the people of this culture were doing what they were doing.